For the better part of the past 13 years, Mark Fisher has written a weekly column in the Washington Post about the world of radio. His column, The Listener, chronicled the highs and lows of AM and FM, described the increasing decline of local radio in the face of new technologies and the rise of conglomerate media corporations, yet always managed to convey to his readers his love of the medium he grew up with as a kid in New York City. Last Sunday, Mark Fisher announced that that week's column would be his last. He wanted to stop writing about radio before it became one endless complaint about what he calls radio's disgruntled decline. Mark Fisher joins us to talk about the medium that we both love and to hear from you. If you're hearing this, you're obviously listening to the radio. Has your relationship to radio changed over the years? Is local idiosyncratic programming still available where you live? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Mark Fisher is here with us in the museum, and thanks very much for coming in, Mark.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And it sounded like reading your column, you were taking advice from your mom. If you got nothing nice to say, don't say anything.
Well, you know, editors in newspapers for years and years have always said, if you don't have anything more to say, you really ought not have the column. And of course, nobody ever listens. They just keep writing the column till they die. And I just thought, you know, what has to be said about radio, I think, has been said now, because radio has reached a point, like a lot of the other old media, where the decline in creativity is on the verge of becoming a death spiral for the business. And as the whole shift takes place to all kinds of new technologies and new distribution systems, some of the old media are looking for ways to stay creative and sharp, and others are really cost-cutting to such an extent that they are unable to hold their own, let alone find a new path.
And the numbers seem to reflect what you're saying, but the way you describe it is almost like the industry has become dispirited and lost faith in itself.
I have to tell you that my email queue has been filled to the brim with notes from program directors, music directors, DJs, station managers all across the country saying, you're absolutely right. We've lost the spirit. We've lost the will to survive. And what's happened is we went through a decade in the 90s of corporate consolidation where a handful of companies bought up literally thousands of radio stations across the country, spent so much money buying those stations that they then had little choice but to cut costs, reduce local programming. I mean, some of the responses I've gotten to this column include station managers writing me almost indignantly saying, why are you saying radio is dead? We still have 6 hours of local programming left on our station. Well, 6 hours of local programming is not impressive.
Yeah, from 6 to 12 on Sunday morning.
Yeah, and so what's taken the place of that, of those local voices that we all grew up hearing and becoming and just being compelled by are nationally syndicated programs, some of which are very good, but all of which sound the same from city to city. And what radio's real distinction is in this new media competition is its localism and its ability to connect with a community. And when it loses that, it is really giving up its competitive advantage.
Yet, why not stay on and lash the industry? You know, kick them when it's down.
Well, I've spent the last several years doing that, and I wrote a book about it, and I thought, you know, I write another column on more general and political issues, and I want to concentrate on that. And on some of the new media things that I'm doing, blogs and chats and that sort of thing, I just thought that a column about radio was starting to feel a little bit stale and was becoming really a catalog of complaint about a medium that needs to redefine itself just as radio did after TV came along in the 1950s. It needs to come up with a new function for itself, and I don't really see that happening.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on this conversation. Our guest, of course, is Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, for many years the author of The Listener, and his book on radio that he mentioned, Something in the Air, was published last year.
That's right.
And let's see if we get a caller on the line. This is Phil, and Phil's with us from Boise in Idaho.
That's correct. Hello.
Hi, but Phil, go ahead, please.
I used to work in radio myself in the early to mid-80s and worked for a couple local stations here in Boise. And I enjoyed it a lot. I never really saw it as a career, but bit by bit, I used to know where all the local stations were, where their studios were, and just bit by bit, each one of them has been slowly picked off, and now there are two or three conglomerates with 6, 8, or 10 stations, and there's the local color, you know, the comments that someone would make about weather and how it affects us specifically, it's all lost, and I hate it. It's a loss of a local voice.
Well, you know,
and I don't have the plan to repair it, but I think it's a loss, a collective loss.
You know, radio really had two golden ages. The first one was the one in the 1930s and 40s, the sitcoms and the variety shows, and that was almost all national programming from the big networks. But that was an age when radio was really had the idea of mass entertainment to itself. And when TV came along and took over, literally those shows walked out one studio door, went across the hall to the next studio and went over to TV, radio was left bereft. And the brilliant solution that came along then was exactly what you're just talking about, that local connection where local mom-and-pop radio station owners in small towns across the country said, you know what, we can provide coverage of local high school sports and the weather and the traffic and all these things that we now take for granted on the radio. And that local connection became the emotional bond that readers, that listeners had with radio stations. We are in danger, and in some cities have already lost that because of the appeal of cheap national programming.
Well, one of the things, well, cheap is an interesting word, and Phil, thanks very much for the call. But cheap is an interesting one of the things that happened. They had to have cheaper programming to replace that network programming, which, of course, no longer existed. And they found that somebody spinning records was, well, hard to beat.
Hard to beat. You can't get much cheaper than taking records that you get for free, a low-paid DJ, or in those days, someone who's getting payola from the record company, and that was the bulk of his income, and putting them on the air. And, of course, running a radio station itself is really quite inexpensive. It was a very inexpensive way to make a lot of money, but along came the 1990s and a way to make money with even less of an investment, because you could simply hook up to the satellite and pipe in Rush Limbaugh and Laura Schlesinger and all the other talk shows.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, another way to even less costly was skip the records and just have that person keep talking.
Right.
Here's an email from Pete in San Francisco. Doesn't streaming audio on the internet offer new terrain for creative radio? Seems like there's plenty of room for aspiring audio artists.
There is, and certainly internet radio has tremendous promise. It's very much like the rest of the internet, though, in that while it fulfills us in all the ways that the internet does, because we can go directly to the people who have the same interests that we do, these are naturally much smaller groups, and so you lose the whole idea that radio really invented in this country, which was of reaching a mass audience. And this has all sorts of political and social ramifications, because you're not able to bring people together around a common foundation as you were in those two golden ages of radio. There are fascinating things happening on internet radio. However, most of the music that is available on internet radio runs in a kind of an Amazon.com model, where it's all based on recommendation engines, and it really has a very automated feel to it, and you don't have the same connections with personalities that you had during radio's better years.
We have a question on the microphone here at the museum.
Hi, my name is Taylor Barnes, and I'm from Bakersfield, California. And although radio conglomerates like Clear Channel have taken over commercial and terrestrial radio and made it kind of mindless, do you think that satellite radio companies like XM and Sirius have kind of brought the creativity back to radio and kind of open the mind of listeners?
It's a great question, and I had tremendous hopes that they would do exactly that, and to some extent they have. There's certainly a far greater variety of music and of other programming available on XM and Sirius than on most commercial radio. However, because it is reaching a nationwide audience, you don't have that local connection, you don't have that feel of emotional bond that you might to a local personality, a local station. Also, for cost reasons, XM and Sirius tend to pick up mostly, aside from their music programming, almost all of their news and talk programming is nationally syndicated. It's in many cases the same programs you can hear on AM and FM, and when it's not, it tends to be the sound from television, the audio from television, which leaves me feeling pretty empty when I listen to it, because you're missing out on the pictures.
Some of those TV programs turn out to be better on the radio.
Well, that's true. You don't have to spend the time watching them. That's true. You can do other things at the same time.
Thanks very much for the question, Taylor. Let's see if we can go now. This is going to be Michael, and Michael's with us from Cape May in New Jersey.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hello? Oh, thank you. I was wondering what's your opinion of community radio? I'm involved with a low-power station in Cape May, WCFA. It's affiliated with the Center for Community Arts down in Cape May. And it's really, it plays to a radius of like 10 or 15 miles. And I understand that there are more low-power LP stations being licensed all the time. Maybe there's 800 in the country right now. What do you think of that as a something that fills in that local connection?
It's a terrific initiative. It was an idea that the FCC came up with. It hasn't quite proliferated across the country to the extent that it was initially envisioned to, because a lot of commercial broadcasters have been fighting against having these low-power stations that are meant to reach a single urban neighborhood or a rural town. These are often community groups, church groups, schools, and so on that set up stations, sometimes political activists. Some of them are just terrific. Some of them are unlistenable, but they're kind of fun to eavesdrop on because it's your neighbors getting on the radio and trying it out for themselves. They are in many ways a reincarnation of the initial idea behind public radio and public radio's own struggle to decide what it wants to be in its next phase. It very much has this same conversation going on between national programming from NPR and other sources and local programming from the individual stations around the country. So that tension exists both in commercial radio and in public radio, but what's happening with these low-power stations is it is indeed a back-to-the-future kind of idea that where you're going back to these local routes. Because these are defined as being so narrow and so local, they're not going to have the same impact on a larger community that a real big grown-up radio station might, but I think they're a tremendous initiative.
Michael, good luck with your station.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Mark Fisher, no longer the listener of The Washington Post, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Another question here at the museum.
Hi, my name is Sarah Lesher. I'm a former print reporter from Silver Spring, Maryland, and I covered many of the hearings that John McCain chaired where Rupert Murdoch and others including Ted Stevens of Alaska, were arguing the issue of localism versus turning everything over to Clear Channel. And there was a sense of inevitability during these hearings that that the FCC was going to win and Michael Powell was going to allow a conglomeration to go forth. And I wonder if there's any way that you see, Mr. Fisher, that this could have been could have happened otherwise.
Michael Powell, the former commissioner of the FCC.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Powell, yeah.
I don't know that it could have politically ended up any other way, but I do think that it can turn around even now. And I think what you're seeing both in Clear Channel and in the other major companies that own thousands of radio stations across the country is that they are not making the profits that they had anticipated, and they are therefore starting to unload stations. And so I think in the next several years you're going to see not quite the wholesale sales that you saw in the 90s, but you're going to see a lot of these stations being spun off, and it's an opportunity for those who still believe that radio can be a great creative force and a great way of connecting communities and making money. You're going to see those folks coming in and buying up stations. So I think there is hope for a de-evolution, if you will, back to what we had before the great consolidation of the 1990s.
Thank you. Here's an email question from Coral in Nashville. My relationship to radio changed in that while I listen to more radio programs more regularly, I rarely listen to them on the radio. I catch most of my favorite shows via live stream, sometimes on my local station, but often on stations from around the country. Similarly, with television, I can listen to shows when I choose as opposed to when my local station plays them. I'm often surprised by traffic and weather from another part of the country during a break from a national program like yours.
There's really a tremendous joy in being able to now range the country and the world and find the music that you want to listen to, whether it's coming from Germany or from California. And yet, there is something lost in that, because although we each individually have far greater choice, we no longer have the community of people to share that choice with. And so, you lose the water cooler piece where everyone comes into work the next day and says, did you hear what so-and-so said on the radio yesterday? And, you know, for many years, that was the sales line, the slogan of many radio stations. It's, the bad boy morning DJ would always be advertised as, did you hear what so-and-so had to say yesterday morning? And we really do lose that when everyone is out there splintered in many thousands of directions.
John is on the mic here in the museum.
Hi, I'm John Asante. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. And my question is, what was the defining moment or moments or possible events that made you distrust radio's future? I don't want to say distrust as like such a harsh word, but
yeah, thank
you.
Seem
to be against it. So,
well, it was really a collection of things that started happening over years. You know, in the early years of writing this column, there was just an endless supply, it seemed, of fascinating characters who I could go around and write about, who were just people who were really bearing their souls on the radio. And if you think about whether it's the all-night guy you stayed up with as an adolescent, or the DJ you listened to as a teenager, we all have in our minds, at least if we're of a certain age, these connections to voices on local radio stations. And as I found that it was ever harder to find such characters to write about, I realized that something was going on. I was going back to the same well over and over again and saying, you know, what's the latest outrageous thing that Howard Stern has done? Okay, maybe we'll write about that. And these kinds of conversations really became rather tedious over time because it was the same story over and over, and nobody wants to write or read the same story over and over.
So do you still listen?
I still listen, but I find myself listening, as the caller said, all over the world and to many different things. There are still some very strong strains in American radio. Public radio obviously is one of them. There are still individual stations here and there, and I try to highlight some of them in the book that are run by one person who just wants radio to connect with its community. But that is becoming ever less common, and so I find myself listening a bit less than I used to, and that's a disappointment. Although on the web, I can go back and listen to the things I listened to 20, 30 years ago and try to relive those days.
We'll miss your column.
Thank you.
Mark Fisher used to write the listener column for the Washington Post. He still writes for that paper on other things. He joined us here in the museum. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.